Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars, and welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. It seems to me, my friends, that the truth is power. And prophecy is power, because Jesus is the truth, and the book of Revelation tells us that Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. Not too long ago, a gentleman came up to me at a church, and he said, "Are you a prophecy teacher?" Well, I didn't know quite, you know, how to answer that. I'm called by God to tell the truth, and of course there is prophetic truth, and on the other hand, every Christian is a prophecy teacher. The whole Bible is full of prophecies, and if we believe in that, then we're all prophecy teachers. So I, you know, was sort of hesitant, not because I didn't mind saying it, but because I thought the man was asking me, really, you know, did I feel like somebody special because I taught prophecy? Well, I don't feel special. I just feel blessed that God has given us prophecies to anyone who will open their eyes and see the truth, not just Tex Mars. So I finally, after some reluctance, says, "Well, yes." And I was trying to sort of get at what the man was after. And he said, "I believe you are, Brother Mars. And the reason why is not because you tell us what is going to happen in the future." But he said, "A true prophet of God tells the truth as it is today." Well, I thought of that. For many hours thereafter, the prophet of God tells the truth as it is today. You know, Jeremiah told the truth as it was in his day, and of course he was thrown in prison and beaten. Jesus told the truth, of course. All of the prophets told the truth as it was in their day. And you know, that's what it really takes. You see, Jesus is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. There can be no time. We don't have any time or space for God, because he has just always existed and always shall. You say, "No, Tex, you're wrong about that." But Jesus was slain in some year, we don't know the year, but approximately 2,000 years ago. And no, that's don't get it in your head that there's a particular time, although we, using man's time and man's calendar, of course, we could point to that date and say, yes, approximately this date, Jesus died on the cross. And this date, 3 days later, he rose from the grave. But you see, on God's time clock, it's totally different. We don't even know what God's time clock is. But we know the Bible says Jesus is that Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. From the very beginning, it was in God's intelligent mind that his Son would die on the cross and be resurrected for our sins. Isn't that astonishing to you, my friends? There was not some point in time and when God said, "This is what I must do," but that it was all decided at the very beginning, and thus there is no sense of time in heaven. As a prophet, and I mean by that that God has called me to tell of his prophecies in the last days, and possibly you too are a prophet then. When you use that kind of a definition, God has called me to tell the truth. You know, it was George Orwell who wrote the best-selling, scary, very frightening novels, 1984. He also wrote a very poignant commentary on politics, including communism, called Animal Form. The Englishman George Orwell once wrote, quote, "In an age of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act." I suppose then that I, Tex Mars, am a revolutionary. I am convinced there are many revolutionaries that follow this ministry. I hear from you quite frequently. You're revolutionaries because you tell the truth. Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote about the gulags of Russia, the concentration camps of Russia. He was tortured there. He should know. During the height of the Cold War, he was exiled, you might say, to the United States of America. He was once asked, why would men do such horrible deeds? And he had an easy answer for it, really. He said, man has forgotten God. I believe that men this century, and we're going now into the new millennium, but it appears when we look over the history of the 20th century, we see that men have forgotten God. They forgot God and they slaughtered millions and millions of their fellow men. They were all, you see, part of the lie. But here's what Alexander Solzhenitsyn, this courageous Russian dissident writer, exiled by communist tyrants for standing up to their cowardly atrocities, here's what he once wrote. He said, the simple step of a courageous individual is not to take part in the lie. One word of truth outweighs the world. Think about that. The world has much to offer. Glamour, glitter, material goods, all kinds of vain and deceitful philosophies, but just one word of truth outweighs all of that. There is a terrible truth to be found in the world today. But you know, truth is lacking, and many people lie and cover up and exaggerate and distort and pollute the truth. Now, this is sort of a build-up for what I'm going to be telling you about today. You see, when you tell the truth, the whole truth, as they say in the courtroom, and nothing but the truth, that's when your troubles begin. Because the liars will come after you. But nevertheless, what you have, that unquantifiable, unmeasurable attribute of truth that you have, that little kernel of truth outweighs everything that can be placed in opposition to you and against God. There are some things that I've exposed this ministry. People say it would be better if you had covered that up. Don't put out our dirty laundry in Christianity. Hide the truth. It would be for everyone's good for you to lie, Tex. There are very few things, though, that I've found are worth lying about. Very, very few. Maybe someday I'll have a sermon just on lying versus the truth. But I say all of that because I'm going to be talking about something today that is so unbelievably horrible that I can barely really discuss it. So bad, so abominable, so unimaginable that it really hurts me. I am absolutely hurt. You know, when I was a young man, I say young, I recall even at the age of 8, 9, maybe 7 years of age, I read everything I could about the Holocaust of the Nazis. It mortified me, it horrified me as a just a little boy. I was a voracious reader as a young man. And that was one of the subjects that I was drawn to because I wanted to know all about it. I could not understand how people could be so brutal and terrible to other people. And of course, there was much, much in the press and books and such, and even movies about the horrors of the concentration camps and the work camps. And I put all that in my mind, and it was just unbelievable to me. And yet I knew much of it to be true. I realize there are some people today that say there was no Holocaust. But of course that's not so. There was a Holocaust. They say, but 6 million didn't die. That's distorted. That's a too high of a figure. Well, I'm not going to argue one way or another on that today. Maybe some other day I'll save that for. But the point is, let us not ever excuse what the Nazis did. But I want to approach the subject a little bit different today. As a Christian, you see, like God, we don't really look at a race and say this is a wicked race, although I believe there have been some wicked races in history. I don't mean to be prejudiced, and I hope I'm not. I pray that God will give me a clean heart in that. But the fact is, some nations have done more wicked things than other nations. That's throughout history. But it's astonishing to me to realize that it seems that there are periods in when even the same nation seems to be peaceful and loving and harmonious and courteous and hospitable to strangers. And then another epoch of history comes and that same nation is atrocious and murderous. We go back to the days in the Orient of Genghis Khan and incredible carnage that was caused by Genghis Khan. And it wasn't just the Germans. We can go back to the days of Attila the Hun in Europe. We can look at Ivan the Terrible in Russia. Yes, looking in the mirror here in the United States, we had William Calley and the massacre of over 100 men, women, and children at My Lai, Vietnam during the Vietnamese War. And I'm sure there were many other unreported incidents of butchering treatment by Americans. So when we look at only the Nazis, perhaps we're losing perspective. You see, the Old Testament says that all those who hate God love death. Does it say Germans? No. Does it say Poles? No. Does it say Jews? No. Americans? Absolutely not. It says all those who hate God love death. That's why there's all of this death and hatred and a lot of the heavy metal music. Once they reject God, they hate God, then death is a natural thing that attracts many. The morbid, the macabre. Today we're going to be looking at something that is terrible, but I believe it needs to be exposed. You see, there's so many books out on the Holocaust. There's so many books out on what the Nazis did, the Germans did. Today, though, I'm going to amaze you. I'm going to tell you the truth about what the Jews did. You say, what are you talking about? Thanks. Yes? For all of my life, I have told people of what the Germans did in the concentration camps. Today, for the first time, publicly, I'm going to tell people what the Jews did. Not only what the Jews did, but what the Jews did to the Germans after World War II. I'm going to tell you, my friends, about the facts of Jews running the concentration camps that were turned over to Jewish masters at the end of World War II, and how they systematically butchered, tortured, and otherwise committed heinous crimes against Germans, against German men, against German women, against German children. Can I prove this historically? Without question. If I could not, I would not bring it up. I would never mention it. But you will see that there is much documentation for this. I want to start off first with an article that I read in the Wall Street Journal entitled The Universality of Evil. A man named David Price Jones was looking at a book. He was reviewing a book called Hitler's Willing Executioners, Ordinary Germans in the Holocaust by Daniel Goldhagen. Mr. Goldhagen in his book, you see, says that the Germans were unique. They were programmed to hate Jews and to kill and be murderous. Of all the world's peoples, they were unique in their barbarism and in this single-minded devotion to kill, says Mr. Goldhagen, who is Jewish, and maybe can be excused for a bias there. Well, Mr. Price Jones says the book is a very fine book and there's much evidence and something to think about. But then he says there is a reservation that arises in his mind, though. He says Poles, Ukrainians, and the people of the Baltic Republics were among the willing accomplices of the Germans, as were Dutch and French and other collaborators. They acted indistinguishably from the Germans. How then can we blame only Germans for what happened in those camps? He goes on to say, parallel evidence from the Soviet Gulag, that's the chain of concentration and work camps within the Soviet Empire, and particularly the Soviet Union itself, run by Lenin and Stalin and all the other monsters of communism. He says parallel evidence from the Soviet Gulag demonstrates that communism was also a culture justifying mass murder. He says Mr. Goldhagen, in his book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, rather summarily dismisses all comparisons of this sort. But, writes David Price Jones in the Wall Street Journal, his book would have benefited from a more thorough discussion of the part played by totalitarianism in general in the destruction of law and morality. In other words, wherever totalitarian governments are, there is death. Well, I want to go one step further. I believe that death is inherently the tactic and strategy used by evil men in every nation, in every political system. Bill Clinton, in what is called a democracy, the United States of America, murdered innocent people. Did he not, when he bombed the aspirin factory in Sudan and lied and claimed it was a chemical factory? Did he not murder people and get away with it? Vince Foster and many, many others. Have we not killed people in nations ranging with the help of the United Nations from Somalia to Rwanda and on and on and on? Well, those don't at all compare, you would say, to Germany and what they did in World War II or the Soviet murders in their gulags. Maybe not. But we're a young nation. Give us time. You know, in his book that we offered the ministry, unfortunately it's out of print now, about gun control being the key to genocide, the two authors, Zelman and Rice, have a long list of perpetrator governments who first imposed gun control on their nations and then went about to kill their unarmed citizenry. They note back in the 1915-1917 era in Ottoman Turkey, in Turkey, Armenians were massacred. Over 1 million were massacred. In China, during the period 1949 to 1976, 20 million human beings were massacred, genocide by the Chinese of their own people. In Guatemala, the Mayan Indians, 100,000 during the era 60 to 81, were killed. In Uganda, Christians and political rivals of Idi Amin, the monstrous dictator from 71 to 79 era, 300,000 of them were killed. Some were fed to crocodiles. In Cambodia, during the period 1975 to 79, 1 million people massacred. Nation only had 3.5 million people, so you can see how many died there. Rwanda, the Tutsis, the tribe, was the target during 1994, and estimates ranging from 800,000 to 2 million died. They say that 57 million people were murdered during the 20th century by governments. It looks like the biggest perpetrator of genocide is government. Makes you wonder why Bill Clinton and the administration are so worried about terrorist acts. Very little terrorism in America, but it looks like there's a lot of murders, genocide being conducted around the world. Now, I mentioned to you that the Germans alone are not to blame for mass murders this century. I'm going to prove my point on that. I have, for example, studied what we as the Allies did at the end of World War II. Now, one man, James Bach, has written two books. One is entitled Other Losses. It created an international uproar. Another book, Crimes and Mercies, written by Mr. Bach. Let me tell you what he proves, documents in his book, with newly declassified documents from the CIA, formerly the OSS back in World War II, and from French, German, and other sources. He found that General Dwight Eisenhower, our leader in World War II forces in Europe, purposely orchestrated the deaths of up to 1 million German prisoners of war. Murdered them. Orchestrated their deaths by setting up concentration camps for them. And that the four wartime allies, Britain, France, the United States, and Russia, agreed on a policy that deliberately exterminated at least 9 million Germans. The death rate over the four-year period was more than double the 1939 death rate, which was the beginning of World War II. Germans were thrown into POW camps and starved to death and beaten to death and tortured to death, and they died of horrible diseases. Germans in many provinces throughout Europe were uprooted from their homes and shipped back, if they could make it back, to Germany. Many of them were raped and killed on the way or put into camps. And then there were some other policies that maybe you never heard about, friends, because these things were covered up. Allied authorities falsified statistics to hide death tolls. Listen to this. The Allies, said Bach, refused to allow the Germans to fish, to make fertilizer, to earn money, to import food, to make oils for tractors and farm implements, to make steel for farm implements, to buy medicine, such as penicillin, and they refused to allow foreign countries to donate food to save the lives of children. What was the purpose? Punish the Germans. Punish the Germans. Now in America, we've read about the Marshall Plan that did so much. The great things that were done, those came a little bit later, my friends. First, there was genocide. Now that was from the Allied side, but the Russians in particular were quite brutal. Let me read to you from Der Freiwillig, which is a German newspaper. And this is not back during the Nazi days, my friends. This was dated March 7, 1995, which is Deutschland Journal, page 7, issue 17. Also, you can read about this in issue 1960, April 23, 1965, Deutschland Journal. It's a report of a German-Brazilian citizen, Leonardo Gier, about the expulsion of Germans from a province in Poland named Silesia. Actually, this was a German province, but the Russians turned it over to Poland at the end of World War II and forced all the Germans out of it. Just gave this piece of land to Poland and then forced the Germans living there. It was a province of Germany. Forced them to leave. Well, they didn't want to leave, so they just made sure they would leave there in East Germany. Remember, the communists now had gained control of East Germany and of Poland. Here's what she says. She talks about, and this is, listen, friends, get ready. I don't want kids to even listen to this. I think this could warp children's minds. Please, if you have a child, please take them from the room. The things we're going to discuss in the rest of this report today that I'm going to tell you about. Because we're talking about Holocaust 2. Holocaust 2, how Jewish avengers, including communist Jews, took revenge against the Germans. And not just Germans who, we might say, quote-unquote, deserved it because they had been SS Gestapo or had run the prisoner of war or concentration camps. No, 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 no. I'm talking about many, many innocent Germans. But I don't want children to hear this. It's too horrifying. Here is what she wrote in an official, and by the way, this is a document which is unassailable. And it's signed also by four different witnesses. And they all confirm that the aforementioned woman, Leonora Gehr, made the report without any coercion, threats, or outside influences. By the way, she lives in Brazil now. And she was in Germany in the province of Silesia at the time the communist Russians, their soldiers, took over. She writes, quote, on the morning of February 16, 1945, a Russian division occupied the Reich Labor Service camp of Wilmsee in Neustetten. The commissar, who spoke German well, informed me that the camp was dissolved and that as we were a uniform unit, we were to be transported immediately to a collecting camp. Since I, being a Brazilian, belonged to a nation on friendly terms with the Allies, he entrusted me with the leadership of the transport, which went to Neustetten, into the yard of what had used to be an iron foundry. We were some 500 girls from the Women's Reich Labor Service. The commissar seemed at first to be very polite to us and assigned us to the foreign workers' barracks of the factory. She goes on to say, the commissar then told me, because I was Brazilian and was not an enemy of the Soviet people, that I would not be harmed. But if I protested to the things that I would be seeing, I would be shot, he said. Suddenly I heard loud screams, and immediately two Red Army soldiers brought in five girls. The commissar ordered them to undress. When they refused out of modesty, he ordered me to do it for them and for all of us to follow him. We crossed the yard to the former works kitchen, which had been completely cleared out except for a few tables on the window side. It was terribly cold, and the poor girls, being nude, shivered. In the large tile room, some Russians were waiting for us, making remarks that must have been very obscene, judging from how everything they said drew gales of laughter. The commissar told me to watch and learn how to turn the master race, that is Germans, into whimpering bits of misery. Now two Poles came in, dressed only in trousers, and the girls cried out at their sight. They quickly grabbed the first of the girls and bent her backward over the edge of the table until her joints cracked. I was close to passing out as one of them took his knife and before the very eyes of the other girls cut off her right breast. He paused for a moment, then cut off the other side. I have never heard anyone scream as desperately as that girl. After this operation, he drove his knife into her abdomen several times, which was accompanied by the cheers of the Russian troops standing thereby. The next girl cried for mercy, but in vain. It even seemed that the gruesome deed was done particularly slowly, because she was especially pretty. The other three had collapsed. They cried for their mothers and begged for a quick death, but the same fate awaited them as well. The last of them was still almost a child, with barely developed breasts. They literally tore the flesh off of her ribs until the white bones showed. I'm not going to go any more in that. That is formal testimony of Miss Gehr. Friends, we're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we're going to be looking at exactly what Jews did to Germans at the end of World War II. You will, for example, see the words or hear the words of a sadistic Jewish man named Shlomo, who is in charge of the camp at Schweintoschlewitz, who announced, quote, what the Germans couldn't do in 5 years at Auschwitz, I've done in 5 months at Schweintoschlewitz. Be right back after this brief message. This is Tex Bars. You're listening to Power of Prophecy. Hello, friends. I'm Tex Mars, and I want to thank each of you for your wonderful support of this ministry. I think that ever so often, I just need to stop and take time and say, God bless you, and may He richly reward you. I pray that you will remember Power of Prophecy in your prayers and your offerings. You know, our expenses as a Bible-believing Christian ministry free from IRS and government control are very heavy. And the postage to send out our monthly newsletter is double because we do not receive the government's so-called nonprofit mail subsidy. We don't, my friends, because we don't want to be beholden to the government, and because, as you know, the IRS requires that if you receive a subsidy, you must obey their guidelines on what you can teach and preach. This cost our ministry many tens of thousands of dollars, but we've sacrificed it to tell the truth. And I praise God that so many of you have written and encouraged and told us that you support our decision to follow after Christ Jesus and stand firm in the face of government persecution and oppression. We thank you for your love gifts. Without you, we would fail. We couldn't go on. We couldn't keep our radio show on the air. We couldn't keep sending out our newsletter, and we're very thankful and appreciative for your friendship, for your courage, and for your faithfulness. Now, here's what you can do to continue to help us. Please give what you can to the Lord's work at Power Prophecy Ministries through your love gifts and offerings. Order when you can our books, tapes, and videos if they will be a blessing to you. And, of course, we'll be glad to send you a catalog of those at your request. Let other people know about Power of Prophecy Ministries. And, by the way, we're on the web, the internet, at texmars.com. Pretty simple. Just my name, TexMars.com. And there is our Power of Prophecy newsletter. And please let people know. That saves us postage when they read the newsletter over the web. But we will send them a hard copy. Upon your request, just make sure that they do want to receive it. And if they want to, you can write to us and tell us. Write to Tex Mars or Power Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. Again, that's the place, the address to send your love gifts, checks, money orders, or what have you, to Power Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. And finally, I ask you, I beseech you, my brethren, to pray fervently for the ministry and staff, that God will continue to bless us and guide us as we fight on to victory in His awesome name. And now we're going to return to our program for today, Holocaust 2, How Jewish Avengers Brutally massacred and tortured helpless Germans at the end of World War II. A few years ago, I came into possession of a tremendous book. It's entitled An Eye for an Eye. The subtitle, The Untold Story of Jewish Revenge Against Germans in 1945. It's written by a man named John Sack. Now, when I saw the cover of the book, I right away bought the book. And by the way, the book is published by, let's see, I want to make sure we have everything right here, Basic Books. That's a division of HarperCollins Publisher. The date is 1993. It's out of print now. We have checked on that, and unfortunately because of political opposition, heavy opposition to Mr. Sack. It's out of print. Now, if you want a copy of this book, you'll have to go to your library, and if it's not there, get it on interlibrary loan. But as I understand it, Jewish organizations such as the Jewish ADL and others, their members, I don't know if it was from the headquarters, but I understand that a lot of their members went to libraries and would check out the book and then throw it away. They did not want people to read about this book. Jewish organizations across America wanted to make sure no one could read this book. Well, we're going to read it today because parts of it, because I want you to know exactly the horrible things that happened in Germany and in Poland at the end of World War II. Now, Mr. Sack, I want you to understand, is Jewish. He was a journalist for 48 years, a newspaper reporter in North and South America, Europe, Africa, Asia. He's written articles for Harper's, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, contributing editor of Esquire. He was a special correspondent for CBS News, a bureau chief in Spain, a war correspondent in Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq, author of seven nonfiction books, including the book M and one entitled Lieutenant Kali. He knows about brutality. Now, one of the things that bothers Mr. Sack so much, being a Jew, is that he's writing about what Jews did at the end of World War II, and it bothered him a lot. You can read it here. He goes to tell, in the first of the book, he tells what the Germans did to many Jews. And it's apparent that his sympathies are with the Jews, being as he is a Jew. But he also says something very interesting. He says, I want to explain why I wrote this book after coming into possession of this knowledge and then researching to find out if these things were so. He said, I believe in the Jewish faith. And in the Jewish faith, I believe it's important that all of the truth come out. Well, I respect Mr. Sack for that. He said, if we cover it up, then Jews will lose, will be dishonored in the eyes of the world if we cover up what we did while revealing what the Germans did to us. We must tell all of the truth, he said, including what we Jews did. I find that very admirable and honorable on the part of Mr. Sack. Now, I want you to understand that Mr. Sack has been greatly punished, and as far as I understand, basically, he has not been able to have any other books published. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe Mr. Sack does. Maybe he's atoned for his quote-unquote sins against the Jews and been able to write other books. But I haven't been able to find any. If you do, let me know. I do know this, though. He was barred from going on any major TV or radio talk shows. And very few people know of the existence of this book. Yet, in the back of the book, he has several dozen pages of sources. In fact, most of his sources, almost all of them, because he wanted to make sure the truth was told, were Jewish. He actually interviewed surviving Jewish officers of these concentration camps. He wanted to know himself if these things were true that he was hearing. Let me give you the names of some of the people that he actually interviewed. Lola Okafor, prison commandant in Gleiwitz. That's a concentration camp where the Jews butchered and tortured Germans. There was Ephraim Bleichmann, intelligence officer in Kielce camp. There's Jurek Cholomsky, officer at Katowice. And I'm very sorry, I don't speak German, my friend, so if my pronunciation is bad, well, please forgive me. I continue now. Barak Eisenstein, intelligence officer in Katowice. David Ferenstein, interrogator in Nisa. concentration camp. All these now were run by Jews. You see, the surviving Jews and other Jews were taken and placed in charge of concentration camps, and Germans were put in the same concentration camps that Jews and Christians and others had been placed in during the war. There was Moshe Grossman, prison adjutant in Gliwice. Joseph Jerkowski, chief of the office for Silesia. Mordecai Kack, inspector in Katowice. Shmuel Kleinhout, prison commandant in Myślowice camp. Adam Krawecki, chief interrogator in Gliwice. Ephraim Lewin, prison commandant in Nisa camp. Moshe Maka, personnel officer at Katowice. Benik Maka, secretary of state security for the province of Silesia. Shlomo Morel, and you'll know more, you'll hear a little bit more about Mr. Morel, camp commandant in Świętochłowice. Shimon Nunberg, interrogator in Nisa camp. And it goes on and on and on, pages, oh pages, I could talk about these things. And just unbelievable. And all of these people talked to Sack. And you won't believe what they told him. And thus his book is entitled An Eye for an Eye. Now, unfortunately, Mr. Sack, not being a Christian, doesn't have an understanding of that verse. And he, being a whistleblower, but also an honest Jew, cites passages from the Torah in which he tries to excuse the deeds of the Jews. You have to understand, this is not a book written about the against Jews. It's for the Jews. He just simply says, we need to show what we did. And not only that, the amazing thing is Mr. Sack justifies the actions of the Jews. He justifies their actions not just for revenge. He actually says that in the Jewish Talmud and in the Torah, he believes what they did was good because it brought about redemption. Now, for the life of me, I can't figure this one out. This is not the definition of redemption that we recognize as Christians. Read Hebrews 9, for instance. But he says this brought about redemption. Well, I think he's going back to the Old Testament where it says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But Jesus said something far different. Jesus said, turn the other cheek. Jesus preached to us to not return evil for evil, but do good to those that hate and persecute us. But this is unknown in the Jewish world. They never forget, never forgive. That actually is the slogan of every prime minister of Israel since that nation was founded. Never forget what happened in Germany and never forgive. This is unusual for Christians because we believe in forgiving. Maybe you can't, maybe the scars are there, but we forgive. Because if we forgive not those who trespass against us, then our Father in heaven will not forgive us for our trespasses. Now, the thing about it is, many of the torturers, the commandants of these concentration camps run by the Jews after World War II that were given to them, they were placed in charge. Many of them were not even themselves prisoners. Many of them were brought in from other provinces and even other countries. So it wasn't that they were exacting revenge. It was that they were just cruel and evil. And however, Mr. Sachs says they were just seeking redemption for what had happened to the Jews in the concentration camps. want to read to you. By the way, the book is very thoroughly researched. It has a note, sources, acknowledgments, and an excellent index beginning about page 245 or so. Let me tell you a little bit about what he says. For example, chapter 4 deals with the liberation of a camp by the Soviet soldiers on January 27, 1945. The Soviets then set up something called the Office of State Security, the OSS. They want to denazify Silesia, the province there, and they want to remove all of the Germans from that province that lived there and had been living, their families had been living for generations there. Now, a woman named Lola, who's talked about quite a bit in the book, Lola Potuk Ockerfeld Blatt, a young Jewish woman, applied for a position at the camp. First, she was a Jew. Next, she wanted revenge. She was made commandant of the prison at Gliwice. She notes, first of all, that while it is true that the Jews did terrible things to the Germans that were within their power to control, she says the Russians themselves, who were not Jews, were even more cruel. They killed the people of Gliwice practically aimlessly, she said. They shot everyone, even Jews and escapees from Auschwitz. She said the women were lined up to be raped, everyone from an 8-year-old child to an 80-year-old nun. When the Russians took charge, they went on a killing and raping rampage in Poland. Well, she says Stalin placed Jews in charge of everything, in all of the camps. And by the way, this was what Sack found. He found that 75% of all of the camps that were set up, 75% of the jobs in those camps, were run by the Jews. As far as Lola, she herself administered her prison like a demon possessed. Innocent men, women, and children are beaten and tortured unmercifully. They were robbed of all their money, watches, and rings. A favorite instrument of torture was called a Totschlager, or beater to death. It was a hard lead ball at the end of a heavy 3-foot spring, and the Jews used him on the innocent German civilians mercilessly. They would go into the cities and the towns, and they ordered all of the Germans out, and they beat them, many of them, to death. Men, women, and children. The homes of all the Germans were confiscated at will by the Jews and taken for their own. On page 70 of Mr. Sack's book is the case, the story of one German home. Ephraim, a Jew, knocked on the door. When a German appeared, Ephraim shouted, "Get out! Leave everything here! Don't ever come back! At once!" And the German, of course, left because they knew the Jews were now in charge of Poland. In chapter 7, there's the story of Chaim Studenki, an interrogator. Chaim was very angry because he'd been interned at Auschwitz himself. Here's some of the things he did. He took an old man who had just one arm left anyway, and he beat him savagely. He beat him so severely he screamed. Then to silence the screams, they used a wooden spoon to stuff rags in his mouth. But how could a man confess to anything that he was being demanded to confess to if he had rags in his mouth? A 14-year-old girl tortured by other Jewish girls. They extinguished cigarette butts, set the girl's hair afire using gasoline. They starved the Germans in the camps. Here's another case. They whipped the soles of the bare feet of the Germans. Then there was the sadistic Jew named Morel Shlomo. He was made a captain in the security service, this Jewish man, and he was put in charge of the camp at Schwantolowice. He was the one who said, "What the Germans couldn't do in 5 years at Auschwitz, I have done in 5 months at this camp." 75% of the Germans in Shlomo's camps were dead within those 5 months. Well, here's what Morrell would do, Captain Morrell, that is. First of all, Morrell's full name was actually Solomon Morrell, called Shlomo for short. Let me tell you a little bit about what the book says here about Mr. Morrell. First of all, he wore the Soviet secret police uniform, and he ran a death camp for Germans just as viciously as any German ran the death camps at Auschwitz and Buchenwald. It says here that Solomon was wore an olive drab jacket with a row of brass buttons on its high black collar, a splatter of silver embroidery. He was a captain in the Office of State Security. He was posted to Świętochłowice, 10 miles from Katowice. And there he drove to work every day in an office Audi. Morrell claimed that he had been a survivor from the Auschwitz death camp himself. But according to the work of Sack, he lied. He said this only to inflame himself and to convince himself that what he was doing was right in his torture and murders of the Germans. We read to you. It says, quote, at 10 o'clock on a cold night in February 1945, a sergeant at Świętochłowice smashed open the brown barracks door. He snapped the lights on and shouted in Polish, Bacznoc, attention! And as the Germans climbed from their beds, Solomon Morrell and a dozen guards walked in. With boots on, Solomon Morrell was 6 feet tall. In his brown leather coat, he had a bear's chest, and on his shoulders were three silver captain stars. He intended to take revenge tonight on his German victims. My name is Captain Morrell, Solomon began. I am 26 and I am a Jew. My father, my mother, my brothers were killed, and I'm the only survivor. I was at Auschwitz, Solomon proclaimed, lying to the Germans, but even more to himself, psyching himself like a fighter the night of the championship bout, apparently filling himself with hate for the Germans around him. I was at Auschwitz for 6 long years, and I swore that if I got out, I'd pay all you Nazis back. Schwein, Solomon cried. He threw down his rubber club, grabbed a wooden stool, and a leg of the stool in his fist started beating a German's head. Without thinking, the man raised his arms, and Solomon, perhaps enraged that the man would try to evade his just punishment, cried, son of a whore, and slammed the stool against the man's chest. The man dropped his arms, and Solomon started hitting his now undefended head. The other guards called out, blonde, black, short, tall, and as each of these terrified men came up, they wielded their clubs upon them. It went on until 11 o'clock at night. The next night, and the next night, and the next night. Solomon led in. The guards stormed in. Solomon would make them sing. They would sing the horse vessel song. And then Solomon and his men started beating them and killing them. As they sang, he would scream louder. If it was not loud enough, he would give them more blows. And every night, more died. And at dawn every day, the Ascension crew transferred them to the ill-smelling morgue. And in horse-drawn carts, to a mass grave near a cemetery by the Rawa River. Night after night into March, into April, Solomon in his brown shirts fell on the brown barracks. Nevertheless, its population continued to grow as trolleys and trucks full of Germans, many of them innocent, arrived. The beds filled up. Soon every bed had 2, 3, or 4 occupants lying head to toe. Now, that was in Solomon Morrell's camp, my friend. By the way, I have a picture of Solomon Morrell. I have the picture of the death camp where he was the commandant. Let me read you another story about Solomon Morrell. One night, he went into one of the barracks. He cried out, "You!" to one German, "Lie down right here." "You!" to another one, "Lie down beside him." "You!" to another one, "Lie beside him." As soon as the three were lined up, Solomon cried out, "You, lie on top of them crosswise." "You," he continued, and he kept piling up Germans, three this way, three that, till he had a human cube as high as a hand could reach. At that point, he and his quote-unquote guest, meaning his guards, started swinging clubs, whacking away at the human cube as if they were hunters and it was a pod of Canadian seals. The air was thick with the grunts of the guests and the thud of the wood upon their bones breaking. In the high tiers of human beings, the Germans cried out, "Bitte, please!" The Germans in the center tiers moaned, but the Germans in the low tiers were mute. For the weight of the two dozen people on top had pushed their Bishira out, and the Germans were dying. "Pigs!" Morrell and his friends cried, pounding away. And then witnesses testify Solomon began to laugh and laugh. Solomon continued bashes all week long, even on Fridays and Saturdays. "How many blows shall I give you?" "None," said one man. "Then you shall have 50, he said. That man died. The guards used clubs, bedboards, crowbars, and the Germans crutches. Sometimes they would swing a German against the wall like a battering ram, splattering his head with blood everywhere. The dead bodies went to the morgue nearly every morning. Dead people's names went to Solomon. He tallied them up every day. 20 from this barracks, 20 from that barracks. And then he had his assistants type out notices. Notice, on July, blank date, 1945, the prisoner, and then in his name, died of a heart attack. He claimed they died of natural causes, but of course they did not. The body count was enormous. If Germans didn't pick up their hairs in the barber shop, they were beaten until dead. If they didn't lick up their own blood after the beating, they were beaten until dead. He forced Germans to beat each other, to jump and break each other's spines, to punch each other's noses. Sometimes Germans would lay sprawled in bread, urine dripping from them. They would cry out, "Mommy, please help me." But their mother, of course, was nowhere in sight. Now, friends, I can go on and on with these things from just this one book, Eye for an Eye, by Jonathan Sack. There is the account, of course, of the Jewish women who were forced to dig up corpses. And then the guards, the Jewish guards, made them lay with the dead, ordered them to hug them, kiss them, even make love to them. The guards used gun butts at one camp to push women's faces into the slime of the corpses. And then they were marched back to their own dormitory where there were no showers. In one camp, 64 of the women died of typhus, a disease contracted from the corpse. And what about the commandants? Well, take the case of Lola. Remember, we talked about her, the commandant of Gleevich. She immigrated to the United States after her term as a commandant. And she's done extremely well in business. John Sack documents that Miss Lola made $10 million in one recent year and lives in a fashionable California neighborhood. And our government does nothing about it. And no one on earth will do anything about these Jews who massacred hundreds of thousands, no doubt, Germans. Now let me conclude with all this, friends. You say, what good does it do to talk about these things, Tex Mars? I want to tell you something, my friends. The truth is always purifying and good. And it is a revolutionary act, but I want to tell you something, my friends. You see, Jesus did not die for Americans or Germans or Jews or Somalis or Mexicans. He died for every human being on this planet. A Christian then cannot be a racist, but a Satan believer, meaning a person who does not believe in God, he can hate any race at any time and do terrible acts. As for a Christian, I think the answer is in Matthew 25. Read that sometime, my good friend. From verse 31 all the way to the end. Jesus says that when the Son of Man comes in His glory, the holy angels with Him, there shall be gathered all nations, and He shall separate them one from another. The sheep on His right hand, the goats on the left. For I was hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer Him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily, I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. This is the Christian. And I pray that Jews, Germans, Poles, all the peoples of the world will come to know the Savior that we do, and that these killings and brutalities will cease. This is Tex Mars. Tune in next week, and tune in each week, and discover the power of prophecy.